Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Remote learning, hybrid schedules, and uncertainty. 15 months into the pandemic derailing classrooms, families and schools are still recovering from the damage. And the damage of learning loss and the toll on mental health is unevenly spread depending on where children go to school and what unique needs they require to be a successful student. In response, the already historic state budget includes record spending on education. We're talking nearly $100 billion, and that's with a B, from pre-K through college. We're going to dive into how this money will be divvied up, the investment in new programs, and address criticism from Republicans at the state legislature who argue they were largely left out of the process. State Assemblymember Kevin McCarty is a Democrat representing parts of Sacramento and West Sacramento. He's also the chair of the Budget Subcommittee on Education Finance. Assemblymember McCarty, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, education is comprising about 40% of the state's record budget. So that amounts to nearly $14,000 per student, more than $21,000 when you account for one-time federal funding. What are the biggest improvements students and their families will experience come fall?
Well, I think the most important thing is school will be back to normal this fall. This past year was very difficult with Zoom school for both students and parents and families and just community. And so we will be back at it this fall in person. So we waive the authority to do this distance learning school. So we'll be back to normal. But also this unprecedented budget just gave us a unique once in a generation opportunity to invest in our schools, our education system from early ed through K-12. So for K-12, which we started with, our per pupil funding is about $21,000. So what does that mean? That's nearly double what it was a decade ago. So this should give a little bit of breathing room to school districts who are having some financial instability like Sac City, but also allow districts to, you know, have lower class sizes, to bring in other programs like music and arts and PE, and to really properly fund our public education system to help our students thrive. We need that in California for our economy as well.
Yeah, and within the budget, it creates the nation's first free breakfast and lunch for all students starting the following year, the 2022-2023 school year, correct?
Yeah, and that's a big deal because, you know, one in four kids in California live in poverty, but among the public school population, it's roughly half. And in some areas, it's roughly two-thirds. And so, you know, if students go to school hungry, you know, they can't learn. And too often students, not only they miss out just on free lunch, but they actually have to, they buy the lunch cards. And sometimes if their parents don't re-up how much there's in those meal cards, they can't eat that day as well. So it just creates a lot of confusion. There's a lot of, you know, shaming for free lunch in school. So we're just making it universal. We're using some federal money and some state money. So it'll be optional. If kids want to eat for free at school, they can, but it's no longer a paperwork issue for eating. And so students can focus on learning, and that will really help student success. And so we're excited that we are the first in the nation to do this.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things we learned over the last 15 months is that school is just so much more than education. I mean, nutrition, social and emotional needs, a safe and stable environment for some students. So repairing that damage, that's more nuanced. Is there going to be an investment in mental health counselors?
There is. And really, this whole learning loss thing is going to take some time to get back at it. I think that, you know, the social and emotional trauma of what's happened in the past year, and some students literally have lost their family members and lost their parents. But like not being in the classroom, you know, my little kids are sixth grade going in seventh grade, and they did okay with Zoom school, but a lot of kids did not. And so going back is going to be tough. And so we did use a lot of our federal money from the relief money from the federal government to use one-time money to hire more counselors and support services to help with this learning loss. So it's going to take some time. But, you know, this budget, this once-in-a-generation budget, first of all, take a step back. We have, it's not irresponsible. We have plenty of money saved for a rainy day. So we stocked away about $25 billion in a reserve for when we have the next recession. But with that, with the economy booming, with, you know, very wealthy people doing very well, ongoing revenues are coming into the state, and we're thinking about, how could we use that to focus on the next generation? So we focus on our schools and our education system. So this is really going to allow us to make sure that California thrives in the future.
Well, the funding, it's not going to be distributed evenly, prioritizing districts with the most needs. And I think it's important to remind us of what the local control funding formula is, because that was created in 2013 during Governor Brown's first term. Just explain how that calculates funding for school districts.
Well, it's based on two premises. The first one is we're going to give the money to districts to spend it as they determine what support in their communities. So no longer these categoricals where we have all these programs determined by the state. So we give the money to the locals so they can focus on their needs. But we do have this premise, which is frankly common sense. If you're in a district with high poverty, high English language learners, high foster youth, it's probably costs a little bit more to educate that community than a district where students are, you know, super wealthy and, you know, have enrichment programs and don't have some of the social, you know, challenges that urban school districts have. So the districts that have the higher percentage of poverty students get more amount of state resources. There's a base amount for each district. So, you know, every student, every district gets a base amount of money, but we have these supplemental and concentration dollars that come to help the districts who need more support to help those students do well. And this is all borne by research. We studied this a decade ago and figured out this is the best way to improve student performance. And, you know, we think that it's working and putting the resources where it's needed the most.
Well, we also learned that over the last 15 months, when it came to distance learning and the virtual environment, that was more challenging for students with special needs. What is being invested to help repair the loss and the damage that was done over the last 15 months?
Yeah, I mean, it's not just students with special needs, but certainly students with special needs. It's harder to focus on, you know, Zoom school when you're in a bedroom with spotty internet sometimes trying to communicate with your instructor. A lot of that stuff is based upon in person. You know, we did have some exemptions early on during COVID to allow special needs students to go in person and focus with their instructor. But, you know, these are things that are going to be lingering for years to come. And so that's why, you know, we put a lot of this one-time money given to schools to be spent over a couple of years to help students you know, get back up to speed. The one thing that, you know, is all students are probably at the same spot. So a lot of these students are going to come in a little bit behind. And so that enables, you know, the educators and the park professionals to work to help bring everybody up as opposed to having a few outliers who are behind. But this is not going to be addressed right away. But, you know, most importantly, we're getting back at it. We're going to be in person this fall. And we're very clear, you know, there are our lawmakers and the governor, and we said, no, we will not do Zoom school again. De facto, it was back in person. So I know my kids and people here in the Sacramento area will be pleased that we'll be back at it. And that frankly allows our economy to thrive. You know, we're going to talk about childcare in a little bit, but it's hard for people to go back to work when school is every other day for 2 hours. We need a functioning school system for parents to be able to go about their lives as well.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with State Assembly member Kevin McCarty about the record spending on education in the historic state budget. You know, you mentioned the funding as once in a generation. California currently ranks 37th in the nation in adjusted per pupil spending. We're the fifth largest economy in the world. Why did it take a pandemic to approve this level of funding for education?
No, I think that's a disgrace that we've been shortchanging our kids and our school system for quite a while. I know there have been measures on the ballot to put more money into our public education system. I still think that we ought to think about doing that. I don't want to be 37th. You know, I want to be in the top 10. You know, why can't California be like New York and New Jersey and Illinois that fund the top 10? You know, we lead the world in economic innovation. We have some of the most, you know, amazing places in California people want to visit. You know, our economy essentially leads the nation in so many things, but our school system is lagging behind. So yeah, this pandemic and this interesting fact that our economy is booming, that the super wealthy are doing very, very well, a lot of people aren't doing well during this pandemic, it allows us to focus on the basics and our education system. So, you know, we should step it up even more. So I'm pleased that we're getting close to the middle in the nation in per pupil funding, but we still have a long ways to go.
You know, given that California has a Democrat trifecta, you know, the governor, both chambers of the legislature have a solid Democrat majority, the budget received criticism from Republicans at the state capitol. They felt shut out of the process. What involvement did they have?
I don't know if that's true. I know that the education budget, for example, many of the Republicans voted for it. I chair the committee with two Republicans on our committee, and we had about 40 or 50 hours of hearings, and they all participated in it. I think there's always, you know, inside baseball, so we know how the system is put together that you know, the minority parties sometimes feel their voices weren't heard. But I think it was a good budget. I know that when they go back home to their districts and talk about increased school funding, helping middle-class families get free pre-K, more higher education access, you know, those communities all across California support that. And so I think overall for the education piece, it's something that we can all be proud of. And there are a lot of elements of this that are, wow. I mean, you can pick probably 10 of these things and be like, this is something that we never thought California would be able to achieve. And we frankly did a lot of this in 1 year, which makes it, you know, kind of daunting to take a look at this whole task that we have here and being able to articulate that to people across California. This budget will change lives, you know, from our earliest learners to people trying to get access to higher education in college or community colleges or UC and CSU. This literally will have a huge impact on the future success of California.
Some of the Republican lawmakers, they wanted more spending on wildfire prevention, reservoir construction, assistance for small businesses, and a further reduction of state debt. What do you say to that?
Well, I think your key word is more. We did that. We eliminated all debts for school districts. We eliminated the pension liability for CalPERS. We put more money in there for small business. We had wildfire relief. I think everybody wants more. I think a budget is a balance. Balance, like any family balances their budgets and needs. You have to do a little bit of everything sometimes. So I think overall, this was a success. But we wanted to focus on how we build back from this pandemic and not just get back to where we were, but do things differently. Because even before, too many people were left behind, especially communities living, people living in poverty, you know, students without the resources and people trying to get to college who can't afford it. So we really focus on how we can use this budget to change the trajectory of students in California to really build everybody back up. And so that was our focus.
The California Teachers Association, they support the expansion of transitional kindergarten investments in higher education, but they also caution that some of the budget driven by one-time federal dollars, and that's really no surprise. But how are these decisions going to be sustainable when we're not dealing with a record budget surplus and if we're at risk of facing another recession?
One thing that we did in this budget versus prior budgets during economic booms is save money for a rainy day. We have $25 billion in a one-time reserve that can help us weather the storm, you know, no pun intended, if we have a recession. We will have a recession. All, you know, over history, we always had economic cycles slow down. So we do have that. The ongoing expenditures that we have for public education, for childcare, for universal transitional kindergarten, are spent using ongoing revenues that are based upon projections from the Department of Finance and LAO, which are appropriate based upon how much we'll have in the future. So we're confident that the new stuff that we put in the budget is based upon realistic financial modeling.
How has the past 15 months shaped or changed the way in terms of kind of lessons learned about investing and being better prepared for the next crisis?
Well, I think that what we've learned in prior budgets and deficits is that we didn't, frankly, save for a rainy day. So we do have this $25 billion saved. But we also realized that too many of the things that we are trying to focus on in California, you know, we're always next year and we don't have enough. So this year we checked issues off the list. Like, for example, you know, we every economist will tell you if you want to change the issues of academic student achievement, you know, if you want to work on intergenerational poverty, if you want to keep kids out of the juvenile justice system, invest in early education. This is something that I've been a big champion of. I know the governor has been pushing this throughout his tenure and even before when he was mayor of San Francisco. So this is something that we, you know, blew the lid off, and we're going to lead the nation in having free, universal early education, and that's going to help, you know, lower income families, but also middle class families who can't afford it. You know, it costs more to go to UC Berkeley for preschool. You know, it costs more to go to preschool than it does it cost to go to UC Berkeley sometimes. And so, you know, having that is really going to be able to help families and kids get ready and thrive by the time they enter kindergarten. So what are we trying to do in this budget differently? Is trying to, you know, invest in what we know really matters to really help improve student achievement and focus on, you know, making sure that we have an economy and a state that works for everybody, you know, not just people that are doing well in the coastal cities or in certain places of California, but places that thrive throughout California, the Central Valley and all across our communities in the great state of California.
Finally, with the last 30 seconds that we have, you know, there's still a lot of uncertain outliers, and we are dealing in some areas with a rise in COVID cases. How will that impact what you and the state legislature are looking to implement with, if there is the possibility of going back to a hybrid or remote learning model?
Well, we know what happened last year, and so we know that we have the opportunity to go do online education. Hopefully we won't have to go there, but we have to be prepared. But we're prepared to go back to school. I know that some of the colleges and universities are looking at mandatory vaccinations, which I support. So that certainly is the hope. So, you know, we don't know. Nobody knows. Dr. Fauci and others, you know, have their fingers crossed, but it's hard to project where we're going. But this is a tremendous time. And one thing too, I did want to talk about, which frankly is the biggest issue, Vicki, that people talk to me here locally, is what we did in the budget for higher education and access to the University of California and the CSU. You know, in the last decade or so, we've been rationing access, having more and more students who are out-of-state students get in the coveted UC slots. So this year, we reduced the number of international and out-of-state students that get to go to UC and expand access for our California students. And so that's gonna mean that about 5,000 more California high school graduates will be able to go to the University of California. Correspondingly, we're doing the same at CSU with about 9,000 new enrollment slots. So that is a huge, huge win in the state budget. So people say, what does that mean for us? You know, all across California, families who have, you know, high school students that are doing well, that have a 4.0 GPA or plus, you know, will have access to go to our great California universities.
Thanks for taking the time, Assemblymember McCarty.
Thank you.
State Assemblymember Kevin McCarty is the chair of the Budget Subcommittee on Education Finance, discussing the record spending on education this fiscal year. Up next, we're less than 2 months away from the recall election. We'll tap into how engaged voters are with the upcoming recall election and how voter turnout can sway or shape the results. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. With less than 2 months to the gubernatorial recall election, there are moving parts that can shape the outcome. I think we've all become accustomed to uncertainty. Well, one outlier in particular, voter turnout. Our next guest will tap into how engaged voters are with the upcoming recall election and if voter turnout can sway the outcome. It is a timely topic of discussion. The most recent poll out of UC Berkeley's Institute of Governmental Studies, published this week, found that likely voters are split on the recall. Mindy Romero is the founder of the Center for Inclusive Diversity at USC. Paul Mitchell is with Political Data, Inc., a bipartisan voter data firm based in California. Welcome, Mindy and Paul, to Insight.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Well, let's just start off with that poll. 47% of likely voters support recalling Newsom. 50% oppose the effort. So that hovers around the margin of error. I'm just curious how much weight you give this recent poll. Mindy, let's start with you.
Well, I think we have to give it a good amount of weight. You know, we're getting closer to the election day of September 14th, election has been set. The environment is changing and shifting. We're all looking to see, you know, how things evolve, how voters support, voters' attention, their enthusiasm, certainly the support of potential recall candidates, or I should say, they're all candidates now, but so, you know, I think it's quite significant, 47-50. We'll have to see if all of those likely voters actually vote. And there's a lot of voters that maybe aren't falling into that category that could become voters and aren't likely in this type of election, but have voted before and could be transitioned into voting to this election. So it's still really early, but it is significant. It's a shift, certainly compared to recent polls.
Paul, what does this tell you?
Well, I think for a lot of people, this is eye-opening to something that we've understood for a while, which is that there's a big enthusiasm gap. So when you look at registered voters in that poll, the number for support is at 36% and virtually unchanged through the months of which they've been doing the survey. The no side is actually 50% in the all registered voters. What's pretty shocking is that when you go to the likely voter screen, which is a measure really of people who are paying attention to the election or maybe have a history of voting in past elections, there's different ways of measuring what is a likely voter. But when you go to that likely voter screen, you see that no side pop up by over 10 points and the race really, really, really closes. So this should be kind of a warning shot for Democrats to kind of wake up to the idea that the recall, yeah, it might have been silly. Yeah, it might not have real candidates on the no side. Yeah, California is very, very Democratic. But if Democrats don't vote, then the recall could be successful. And I think a lot of Democrats might be thinking, well, I don't support the recall, so I'm just not going to vote. That's not supporting the recall. Not supporting the recall is actually voting no. If you're not voting no on the recall, then you could be inadvertently contributing to a kind of an amazing result, which would be the recall of California's Democrat governor.
Well, Paul, going with that, I mean, indifference can be powerful, right? And so in that same poll that you were talking about, among all registered voters, 36% support the recall, 51%, as you just mentioned, favor retaining Governor Newsom. So that gap gets wider. But what does this tell you about voter engagement?
Well, it really, I think that what we're looking at is a poll. What will be the actual voter engagement is still to be determined. Trying to figure out a methodology as a pollster to determine what likely voter turnout is going to be in an election in September of an odd numbered year where the only thing on the ballot is a recall election. I mean, our past elections we can look to for any signals. The most recent similar election was an election in 2003 where there were only 16 million voters. There's 22 million voters now. There's a record number of registered voters, and a tiny sliver of that population actually was voting in the 2003 election. So there are very few voters on the voter roll right now who participated in the last recall. The last recall is so long ago that it's not really indicative of what we should expect in terms of turnout. And we also can't look to the most recent gubernatorial or presidential election in 2020. With huge national media and really huge turnout. We can't even look to 2018 when we had the last statewide election with gubernatorial candidates, statewide candidates, because of the national environment during that election cycle as well. So there is no real clear kind of look back to a model for who's likely to vote. We can look to things like Berkeley did, which is essentially trying to measure enthusiasm or interest in the election to determine who's likely to vote. But even that is problematic. So we'll have several polls, I'm sure, leading into this election. But it might be that polling is going to be less indicative of the final result in this cycle because pollsters don't have as much solid footing in determining what is a true likely voter. When we start getting ballots in, that might be some early signal. If certain groups in the population, like Mindy's done a ton of research on younger voters and Latino voters and their lack of participation in an election like this, And if they are not turning in their ballots as we get closer to election day, that could be a bad harbinger for the governor.
Mindy, what are those groups kind of telling you when you're kind of gauging the temperature of interest and engagement?
You know, if I may, I want to just start off by saying that, you know, we're talking about what turnout might be and what, you know, what the fate is for the governor, right, and those who want to replace him. But ultimately, turnout's important, not just for the governor's chances, but for, this is a major decision, whether you agree with the recall or not, right? We have it. And we all hope, you know, for the sake of our democratic process, that we have a good turnout and that it's a representative turnout. In an election like this, which is, even though it's no longer officially considered a special election, it is. And as Paul said, we don't have a lot of indicators right now to tell us what to quite expect, but we do know that getting good turnout is going to be challenging. People need to know that there isn't even an election on September 14th. We just all got the date. They need to think that it's important, that it's, they need to understand what it means, what their vote means, why they should participate. I think there's going to be a lot of voter confusion, and they need to also feel that it's salient and relevant, right? And that can be an even greater challenge for historically underrepresented groups who often don't turn out as much in special elections or low turnout elections, aren't reached out to, courted by candidates. I know the governor wants to get all the votes that he can, but it's going to be, I think, a challenge to see a representative election. We've never seen a representative election, I should say, where the percent of voters by race, ethnicity, age, income actually matches the population. But I think it's gonna be more of a challenge in this type of election. And so to answer your question in there, hopefully, but it's just to say that there are consequences for how people view this election, the legitimacy of the election. We know, win or lose, whatever the outcome of the recall, there's gonna be a lot of spin, you know, and in terms of, how close it was, whether it was perceived as a power grab or a money waste or whatever it might be. We want to make sure that at least it's part of that conversation. We've got it. As many people are participating, having a voice in this, and that will be a challenge.
Well, when talking about spin, I mean, that brings up a good question. Is it just about winning, or is it by winning by a wide margin for the governor for it to be looked at as a success?
Well, I think that for the governor, it's about winning, right? I think that is the most important thing. But I do think that there's an important point that Mindy brings up around that and your question regarding the spin on this. It would be great for Democrats nationally for this to be a big blowout win for the governor. It could provide a message to Democrats nationally that those who were taking what they perceive to be kind of the responsible choices during the COVID era, those that were tackling big problems with the economy and all the challenges we've had in the last 18 months and ongoing, that those Democrats are going to come out of this period and be able to rebound. I think that people who, everyone from Governor Whitmer in Michigan to other Democrats around the country who have been kind of under attack, and also for congressional races, U.S. Senate, and everything going into the 22 election cycle, the big election cycle after redistricting, having a resurgent Democrat on a national stage could benefit Democrats in a lot of that kind of spin going into the 22 cycle. If the governor were unable to beat this recall, that could be pretty positive spin for Republicans to say, look, we are now rebranding ourselves. We are reconnecting with voters. We have something that we're against. And we are going to go into the 22 election cycle and be successful in a number of places where Democrats are still retaining state legislatures, congressional seats, governor's offices. So I do think that this will be somewhat of a odd bellwether for the 22 election cycle. And that for better or worse, or whether it is intellectually justifiable or not, we'll probably see people trying to read the tea leaves going to the 22 cycle based on what happens in this recall.
And if I may add, I really do think that he has to go for it. It can't be close. He wants it to be as large a margin as possible. Because if it is close, that will be spun around as a defeat, right? Well, the recall proponents will say, well, we didn't get him out, but we almost got the you know, the Democratic governor in a solid blue state like California ousted. What can we do in other states, right? The narrative will still almost be just as powerful. Plus, you know, Newsom wants a political career beyond California. He wants to get reelected, but we know he has ambitions beyond California. He wants to turn this around, right, to be a narrative that shows kind of a victory when he was attacked by, right, a power grab and so forth. So that's why I think polls, getting back to the one that was just released, polls and numbers like that are concerning, because even if he can, as we all still, I think, expect him to win, he doesn't want it to be as close as some of these numbers are suggesting it could possibly be.
To be too sour, I totally agree with Mindy. But I think because of this poll that was released this week, it's very easy for us to focus on that. There are other signals in this polling and other polling about the weakness of the field against Newsom. It's not technically against him because they're not on that's two different ballot questions. But even if Gavin Newsom wins this recall, the no side wins by one vote. The likely outcome on the replacement candidates is that you're going to have candidates, one of whom was the Republican nominee in 2018 for governor, others who are trying to use this to build towards a gubernatorial race in 22. Coming in single digits or in low teens, or even having a situation where maybe one of them gets up to 20 or 30%, but upon further inspection, 40% of voters didn't even pick a replacement candidate or something like that. So there could be a situation where the Republicans who are in that recall ballot walk out of this having been worse off for it.
Right. I mean, 40% of likely voters in that poll, I mean, that's when we're talking about the most recent one, they remain undecided on a replacement candidate. So that also can raise an issue with that second question. Paul, when you're looking across the state, are there any surprises you're seeing?
In this polling? I think one of the surprises is the Latino population is not rallying behind the governor as of yet. Now, progressives and Latinos might start rallying around the governor when they do start to look at these replacements and look at the agendas that these replacements might bring in. So we're in an environment right now where we might be a year away from losing Roe, and that we might have states around the country where women's right to choose is going to be essentially eliminated effectively after a Supreme Court decision, probably in June of next year. Do we want to have a pro-life governor at the helm in California when that happens? When we have serious concerns about DACA or, you know, healthcare for non-citizens and other issues that California has been leading the way on, what would it mean to have one of those replacement candidates be at the helm? And so it's possible that as this gets to be a more serious potential outcome, that the recall is going to be successful, that the, you know, putting a highlighter pen to the records of those replacement candidates could reel that back and bring some enthusiasm back to populations that have traditionally been solidly in the Democratic column.
But there's not a lot of time either. September 14th coming up fast, ballots being mailed out mid-August. It's a race, and Gavin Newsom has a huge war chest of money. And I agree, more allies that need to come out to help get out the vote, particularly for the Latino community. And but there's not a lot of time for the placement candidates to make a solid case either.
Right. We got 7 weeks. And just on Monday, Gavin Newsom announced that, you know, all state workers, healthcare workers will need to be vaccinated. But also in that same announcement, he took aim at, you know, conservative voices who he says perpetuating false, misleading narratives about the vaccine. Is this part of this larger playbook to get more aggressive and vocal about this issue with really an encroaching deadline to this recall election?
Well, you know, my specialty is more in the data, the numbers, the voter files and that. But, you know, I think that it makes sense from a messaging standpoint for the governor to be out there and being aggressive about trying to find solutions. And in particular, when it comes to schools and kids being able to get back into school. And I know in your earlier segment, you talked about that. But the ability for parents to feel like that policymakers have solved some of these issues that have been really challenging them over the last 18 months with their kids and access to, you know, a good education. Those kind of things are the kind of things that could trip up this governor going into the last weeks of the recall if there are real problems with our recovery from COVID.
And other factors like the wildfire season, other unknowns, right? Surprises. And let's be honest, unfortunately, I think for voters and for the governor, every decision that he makes around COVID right now, every announcement he makes, every decision he makes around other aspects of the state, right, economy, wildfire, so forth, he has to be thinking about how it's also going to land in terms of the recall election, at least in terms of, at the bare minimum, the framing of those decisions. And that complicates everything that much further when we're trying to talk about what good policy is and what the next steps are. Is this big monkey, elephant, whatever we want to call it in the room.
Yeah, well, I guess even with that, you know, the first recall debate is going to take place next week. And I believe like there are five GOP candidates that are going to participate. Governor Newsom reportedly didn't even respond to the request. However, two candidates, Larry Elder, who is currently in the lead with 18% of support, and Caitlyn Jenner, they're not participating. And this is the first recall debate. What does that tell you that there are GOP candidates choosing to not even participate with 7 weeks to the election?
I think that's going to be the least watched political debate in California history. I mean, it's going to be a bunch of B-list, you know, replacement candidates. And so I guess it's not surprising that it's kind of has lackluster interest. I think that if we did have a much clearer sense that the recall would be successful, then we would have had probably better candidates filing a more serious probable focus on, you know, these kinds of debates. But right now, I think that debate is going to be pretty, that's going to have low ratings.
And let's face it, it's a far cry from 2003 and having Arnold Schwarzenegger in the race, which was a big factor in why turnout was much higher than I think initially expected for that type of election. He brought national, international attention and a lot of attention from voters. And I think before we end today, I just really want to emphasize the amount of work that needs to be done. Forget about, you know, how you want voters to vote, but just educating voters about the election period. There is an election, right? What it means that you should participate, even if you, right, feel like your candidate's not going to win or is going to win, why it matters to actually vote, that your vote is actually going to make a difference. It's important to be counted. And literally the nuts and bolts of what a yes means, what a no means. I think all of that's really important. It can impact whether people vote, whether they're comfortable and confident in their voting. And ultimately affect, again, turnout and representation. So just emphasizing, I think the people can be enthusiastic. It doesn't mean that they fully understand what the recall means and what their vote means. And so we have a lot of just public voter education to do, particularly for groups, again, that are not going to get that outreach, that are harder to connect with in terms of those public messaging and also campaign messaging.
And I think it's important to remind listeners that this is going to be different than 2003. Both I mentioned earlier with many, many more registered voters, but also we're going to be mailing ballots to every California voter, 22 million ballots being mailed. So if the challenge for those low enthusiasm voters was getting up on a Tuesday morning, going and standing in line somewhere to go vote in person, in fire season, in, you know, dealing with kids going back to school and it's the middle of September and what am I doing? That might be a much more challenging election cycle in which to get these low enthusiasm voters to actually participate. But if you're getting mailed a ballot, it's postage paid. There's one question on the ballot, or actually two, but you have to, you know, and I think that is maybe the thing that could be part of the saving grace for the Newsom campaign and the no on the recall side, that voting is just going to be so much easier in this election cycle. And I think the biggest concern they should have is to message to voters that if you're against the recall, throwing your ballot in the trash is not being against the recall. Being against the recall requires an affirmative no vote and putting that ballot back in the mail.
Absolutely agree. I think that everyone getting a vote by mail ballot is a tool, right, for candidates, voter education efforts, voter outreach efforts. Tell people, look for that ballot in your mail. You weren't expecting it. It's there. Use it. It's simple. It is, you're not going to have to do a ton of education or at least a ton of research as you would on a longer ballot. But people still need to know that it's there and why they should pick it up and open it, right?
Mindy and Paul, thanks for the chat and taking the time.
Of course. Thank you very much for having us.
Mindy Romero is the founder of the Center for Inclusive Diversity at USC, and Paul Mitchell is with Political Data, Inc., a bipartisan voter data firm, and they're chatting about the upcoming recall election. Still ahead, as cases rise due to the Delta variant, some businesses are creating their own COVID-19 protocols as protection. We'll hear why they're going beyond public health guidelines. You're listening to Inside here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Inside on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The Delta variant is pushing some businesses to take COVID-19 protocols into their own hands, adopting their own stepped-up requirements, from requiring vaccination cards, masking indoors, which goes beyond current public health guidelines. So, to better understand the concern, CAP Radio's Ed Fletcher checked in with businesses around the Sacramento area. Ed joins us now with their concerns and protocols they're putting in place. Welcome to Inside, Ed.
Thanks for having me.
We're talking about small businesses that really shouldered a significant brunt during the pandemic. Why take on enhanced COVID-19 protocols?
These businesses were some of the first that were shut down and the last to come back. And they're afraid that they're going to have to shut down again. So they don't want to be part of the problem. So they're trying to do what they can to try to be part of the solution and to make sure that their customers and their staff are safe.
You spoke with multiple small businesses in the Sacramento area. So let's hear what some of them have to say. You stopped by Torch Club. That's a blues club dating back to the 1930s. What did they tell you?
She was very concerned about more and more people not wearing masks inside the space. And how do you even do that in a bar when you're trying to drink and talk to your friends and dance? So she felt the safest way is to start requiring proof of vaccine.
I decided I wanted to get ahead and be more on the preventative side and try to minimize the spread. As it would seem, the best, safest way to handle that would be for people to wear their mask and show their vax card. I'm looking at this as for people that choose not to, then you shouldn't go out. If you can't be safe, then why should we be at risk? This is giving people a reason to get vaccinated so they can be out. And the people that already are, so they can feel safe.
Yeah, and when you were chatting with Marina, the owner of the Torch Club, were customers and guests receptive of these protocols?
The reality is that for the real customers that come there, they appreciated this. She is getting some pushback from people that probably aren't customers, the people that have made threatening comments or been vulgar to her and her staff. So, but looking at the pictures and seeing what I saw, there are enough people that are appreciative and that want a safe environment and appreciate knowing that everybody in the room is on the same page.
Yeah, live performances. I mean, they were essentially shut down for a year or longer due to the risk of, you know, airborne transmission. You also stopped by the Comedy Spot. You know, that's where there's a lot of laughter. Oh, what were their concerns?
Well, the owner, Brian Kroll, you know, he's a great guy. And he, again, didn't want to be part of the problem. You think about a comedy club. What's your goal? Your goal is to make them laugh and to expel air from their lungs. So that practice with everybody being unmasked felt inherently unsafe if you're sitting next to people. So rather than have that fear in the air. He wanted to try to get ahead of the problem and enact their own rules.
We just decided before we were told to put on masks, we're going to go ahead and do it anyway because we want to protect the people that are around us. I don't know. I guess I'm of the opinion that if everybody vaccinated up, you know, we might be able to get rid of masks and things like that. But it just hasn't been the case. And we just don't want to, I mean, we want to protect people. I want to make people laugh. I don't want someone to get sick or even worse.
Yeah, I think the overarching message really is just being proactive. You know, when talking with Brian, what kind of feedback and response has he received from guests?
Again, mostly positive, but also that it's become so politicized that people feel compelled to try to speak out against it, even though they may have had no plans of going there in the next few days. So unfortunately, there is that divisiveness, but they're still finding an audience, and it's making them comfortable being in that place and doing what they love doing around others.
Right. So I'd imagine, you know, it's obviously what we're talking about. It's not the most popular requirement for everyone. How are other businesses dealing with frustrated customers? Because it's not only, you know, live venues.
Yeah, I talked to Leslie Nesbitt. She's the owner of the tech shop in West Sacramento, Tech Exchange in West Sacramento, sorry. And she was just concerned that when people come in, like, they don't have a mask anymore. People have gotten so used to the no mask requirement that they feel comfortable going around town without a mask. And she's asking people to mask up in her business. And unfortunately, they don't have it. So it's been a challenge. But for the most part, she says they get on board.
But it's very difficult to ask our customers to wear them again since the mask mandate has been lifted.
Yeah, I mean, that's adding a whole other layer to an industry like the Sacramento Tech Exchange. You know, you got to rely on customer service, and that's just adding another challenge when you're a business that was already struggling for the better part of 15 months.
And there are some businesses where you can put up big plexiglass walls and it's a quick exchange, and the retail person can feel like they're relatively protected. But if you're trying to lay down a laptop and show somebody what happened with the computer, it's a face-to-face interaction for a while. So that's where she felt comfortable, is asking people to wear a mask.
Finally, Ed, what are you interested in following up on in the weeks ahead?
Well, it's been interesting to see how this is spreading. I really wonder where the state is on this and whether or not they will move in this direction. As we all saw, there was talk about having some sort of way to prove that you have a vaccine, and it became politicized when we started calling it vaccine passports. And people dug in against this idea of a vaccine passport, and now we're looking for new words to describe a vaccine passport or a way to show that you have been vaccinated. It'll be interesting to see what large venues like the NFL do this coming season. That's an opportunity for large sections of America to be encouraged to vaccinate. So I'd love to see what happens in that area.
Yeah, still a lot to follow. Thanks for sharing your reporting, Ed.
Thanks for having me.
Cap Radio's Ed Fletcher checking in with businesses about their concerns and enhanced COVID-19 protocols they're putting in place. Well, that's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director, Mark Jones, and our engineer, Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here on Monday.